Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian with me, Alex Kratosky, in Louisiana.
And me in London, Charles Arthur.
And me, Samuel Gibbs.
This week on the podcast.
Obviously, life has both images and audio to it, so being able to sort of connect the platforms like this, I think, from a user perspective, makes a lot of sense.
We hear from SoundCloud co-founder Alex Leung after his big announcement of a tie-in with Instagram at the TechCrunch Disrupt conference in Berlin. Also, Jason Phipps will be picking out some of the highlights of the first Disrupt in Europe. And the Guardian tech team and I will be looking at some of this week's biggest news, including the introduction of face recognition technology in Tesco, the Raspberry Pi-enabled mini screen that took a mere 50.5 hours to hit its Kickstarter target, and Twitter is about to throw itself upon the market. We'll be taking a sober view of the impending IPO. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First up, we look at this week's tech news. Charles, the technology in the films Minority Report and Blade Runner is rapidly, surprisingly, becoming part of everyday life. And this week, the future became the present again, as Tesco announced its plans to use a face-scanning system to deliver tailored adverts at its petrol stations. Now, sure, gas pumps aren't nearly as sexy as Tom Cruise's or Harrison Ford's trips through the fashion outlets of the future, but then real life really is never as glamorous as the movies. Charles, what? Face recognition software at gas pumps?
So it's the company which actually made this. So Tesco is the company where the adverts will appear, but it's being sold to them in effect by a company called Amscreen, which you might be able to figure out from the sort of from the root of the stem of the name is actually a sugar. It's an Alan Sugar production, except that the production in this case is Simon Sugar, who's his son. And they have licensed the technology from a French company called Quividi, based in Paris. And what Quividi does is it takes the output from a camera, sort of video camera, and it uses some software which then makes a calculation about the gender of the person that it's looking at and the rough age. So it splits it into children, young adult, adult, and senior adult, as they call it. And that's basically all it does. And then passes that information back of you know, roughly who's in front of the camera. It passes that back to the Amscreen system, which then finds an advertiser who wants to show an ad to a young adult, adult, senior adult, whatever it is, as appropriate. And it can also figure out how many people are waiting in line. So if you had, say, four women and one man, then maybe you'd share an ad that was more appropriate to women, or vice versa. So that's what it was about. But Kei Kwang, who's the chief operating officer of Quividi, told me it's not a face recognition system, it's a face scanning system. And he was very determined to make this point, which is that they don't store any data about people and that it's not about recognizing who a person is. It's simply recognizing, if you like, what a person is and just sort of drawing these rough delineations between gender and age.
Thus sidestepping the privacy question.
Well, certainly, I think in their view, they sidestep or simply don't get involved in the privacy question. If you think about it, they could have a human being sort of sitting there thinking, yeah, okay, this looks like a man, probably age about 50, so I'll show them this advert. It'd certainly be labor-intensive. As to whether it'd be cost-efficient, yeah, that's a different question. I don't know whether you'd think that was a privacy question or not. As ever with these things, once things get automated, that people get a bit itchy about it. But in the general sense, because then they're insisted they're not storing this data, although there hasn't been a full audit on it, the question of privacy and data protection doesn't seem to arise.
So where are they actually doing the recording? Is it when you're at the pump sort of picking your teeth or staring deeply into space? I mean, how are they doing all of this?
So no, when you drive into a petrol station, pretty much any petrol station actually, then the number plates of your car will be spotted and matched and checked against a national register that all the companies keep of cars which you've absconded. If it's not on that, then generally you'll get your petrol and then you go into pay in the shop, and it's in the shop that these adverts will be targeted at you.
So there's really no kind of way to break the system or to disrupt it, is there?
Well,
you're going to be captured.
In Quivedi's own tests, they found in a test they carried out in the States that wearing a baseball cap seems to confuse the system quite a lot because it obscures your forehead, which is an important indicator for gender. And obviously it obscures your eyes, which has the same sort of effect. And of course, Tesco, like many other petrol systems, has a pay at pump option. So you could just go, if all you need is petrol, you could just pay for the petrol at the pump and make your way off and never have to stand in a line.
This is, I have to say, I'm slightly dismayed at the number of stories that we cover about all of these futuristic technologies and how essentially they all kind of boil down to the ways that we can get adverts delivered to us more directly, you know, more relevant ads, the way that technology is used basically to get us to part with our cash. I mean, am I just being dystopian? Am I just sort of despairing needlessly?
I think that it's certainly the case. I mean, there was a fairly famous article which appeared in Bloomberg Businessweek a year or two ago, where a top software engineer said, "I suddenly realised that my days and all my talents were being used just to figure out a way to show ads to more people," and that he'd basically given up on the well-paid job that he had at a sort of well-known startup because of this. So yes, it does seem as though a lot of effort goes towards just showing us things to make us want to buy stuff. You could say that it is a little dispiriting that all this effort and all this skill should go to doing this rather than to finding some other way of enhancing your life, rather than perhaps making you feel that your life is a bit empty because you don't have, you know, the Breathe Easy liners for your shoes or something. you know, it's sort of the way of the world a bit, isn't it? And I suppose it's indicative that Google, which was so much a sort of an eighth wonder of the world in the fact that it could search the early web and turn up just the right page that you were looking for, is in effect a gigantic machine for pouring out advertising at us, and that the thing that they find themselves most proud about is that they can serve you relevant adverts, when for many people the issue was never that they wanted to see relevant adverts, they just didn't want to see adverts. And I think that the rise of people using software such as Adblock is actually indicative of this, that the people just feel they'd like to have a life a bit more free of adverts. And certainly if you've been in the US, and certainly, you know, I know from my visits there, if you watch television in the US, and I know you're there in the moment, the contrast between US TV, the ad-supported TV, and the cable TV, such as HBO, or indeed, you know, the sort of stuff that we have in the UK, is just night and day in terms of the tolerability of the adverts.
Oh, it is. And people revel in the fact that they're the fastest finger in the West, that they can, you know, they can hit the mute button as soon as they know there's an ad coming to simply block them out. And also the rise of systems like TiVo or other systems that are, you know, Hulu in the US, that allow people to kind of extract the ads from their programming is indicative as well. But Samuel, what do you think? Are we just being negative? Are there plenty of positive things that might come out of this face, not recognition software, but this sort of face comprehension software that Charles and I are missing because it's too quickly attached to a petrol pump?
I'm sure there are, but somebody has to pay for it in the first instance, which is why it always comes back to advertising.
You're such a realist.
It's the kind of thing that once we have the ability to identify gender, and maybe even go as far as people, that will unlock new technologies, new things we'd never really thought of. But, you know, somebody's got to pioneer it. And if it's advertising and it's not too invasive, well, fair enough.
So the future will be subsidized by, well, us. And you can see more from Charles on this story at theguardian.com/technology. In last week's Tech Weekly Education Special, we looked at the ever-growing power of the maker movement. One name in this space pops up almost as regularly as a pop-up for teeth whitening services. It's Raspberry Pi, the stripped-down, compact, and bijou open-source PC. And this week, a Kickstarter campaign to fund a low-cost 9-inch HD screen for the device made the headlines. Samuel, what is the story here?
It's essentially built on the same principles, with a project for a low-cost screen that you can put together yourself. it's basically to go fill the space, because there aren't that many low cost screens, especially when talking low cost is under £100. It's a 9-inch screen, 9-inch HD screen, which is similar resolution to some of the tablets that we see today, including the Tesco Huddle, but slightly larger at 9-inch rather than 7-inch. And it just kind of really captured the imagination of Raspberry Pi modders, but also the people who were looking for like a cost-effective way of adding a screen to another device. It accepts anything that outputs via HDMI.
So basically, what happened was that a couple of folks, I mean, who's behind this in the first place?
So it was all kickstarted by a famous Raspberry Pi blogger called Alex Ames, who blogs at raspberrypi.tv. He identified the trend, identified that there was a real need for this kind of low-cost screen, and then partnered up with Dave Meller of Component Supplies Syntech, who supply components for basically home hacking projects and things like that. And together they kind of saw that there was a need for this, but they also needed support to get it to a point where they could actually deliver it. Because the problem with these kind of production runs is that you need thousands to really get the cost down. So their idea was to target Kickstarter, which is why they launched the Kickstarter campaign, to try and get into the volume that was required to really push the cost down and deliver the modifications they required. I mean, there were quite a few off the shelf components they could have used, but they're often much more expensive than they really needed to be, because they do a lot more than is required. In this case, the board that powers the screen, for instance, only requires HDMI because that's what the Raspberry Pi outputs. But it's really difficult to just get a HDMI compatible board. They always have something like DVI or other connectors for generally connecting to a computer. So by going to Kickstarter, getting lots of people on board, which they did very successfully, hitting their £55,000 goal with 26 days to spare. I think it was 50.5 hours in total on Kickstarter before they were viable. They've got that volume to really push it home.
That is extraordinary. I mean, we've heard about a lot of Kickstarter campaigns that have been wildly successful. Obviously, we've heard less about those that have not been wildly successful. But I'm impressed that we keep hearing about these amazing success stories. Why was this particular one so popular? Why are people so captivated by the idea of getting an HD monitor for their Raspberry Pi?
Well, it sounds so simple, but the Raspberry Pi offers such a fantastic opportunity for creating your own essentially computer. And it's small, it's low power, which means it could be portable. But the main problem with that kind of project is that the portable screens are few and far between, and like I say, expensive. They're generally designed for photographers and videographers in mind, and they come with that kind of price tag well in excess of £100. So that what they're targeting was £65 to £75. So it really captured the imagination. But it's not just for Raspberry Pi. I mean, for instance, a couple of years ago, I tried to set up an auxiliary screen for my computer just specifically for instant messenger chat, and I determined that a monitor in the region of 5 to 7 inches was really ideal, but I could not find one that was cost effective. I mean, most of them were in excess of £200, which was kind of not worth it. But you know, something at £75, wow, I could do all sorts of things with it. I mean, you could turn the Raspberry Pi into a portable gaming console with that, anything like that, portable media player. The screen really kind of unlocks the potential of the Raspberry Pi.
Is something like this potentially something that might take away markets from, say, the Apple iPhone App Store, particularly the games that you mentioned, or even any Android handset or tablets play service? I mean, would people suddenly move over to a Raspberry Pi if they realize that the possibilities were not only endless, because you could get these, you know, you could get apps and software there that are potentially more powerful, but also you can hack and you can play around with them.
I'm sure it'll appeal to a certain market, but I don't think Google will be quaking in their boots, because it's just not going to be hitting the kind of volumes that, say, an Android device would. I mean, when we talk about thousands of sales of say a screen like this, it's a small drop in the ocean compared to most Android handsets or the iPhone, for instance. So yes and no, I think they'd be looking at it, seeing what works, what doesn't. They'd be fools not to see what people do with these kind of things. But they're not really threatened by this kind of thing. It's great for hackers, great. Modders, and enthusiasts, but the general public probably not really.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Sam. You could read more about this at theguardian.com/technology. As we record this podcast, we are literally tens of hours away from Twitter's initial public offering, the IPO that will launch the ubiquitous global social network into the lion cage that is the free market. For a company that has yet to show a profit, projections of its worth outstrip the last big tech IPO. That was Facebook in May 2012. Charles, here we go. I mean, everybody's watching this story. What is the projected share value, first of all?
The expectation is that Twitter will float at between $23 and $25, which would rake in about $2 billion in total. They could actually raise 20% more if they choose to free some more shares, which would be more than Google raised in 2004 when it went public.
Holy cow. So are we at a different phase? Did Google set the benchmark?
I think that Twitter is basically, I mean, what you're doing when you do an IPO like this is that you are gathering a whole lot of cash, which you then have as a war chest in order to fund expansion, buy companies, hire the best employees. You're basically setting yourself out for, you know, life in the big, wide, vicious world. And I think that Dick Costolo, who's the chief executive, is basically thinking here, let's get all the money in now, and then we can figure out what to do with it, because they've got very aggressive plans to expand. And of course, they've also need to be able to build Twitter as an advertising platform, because they have to make that money back somehow.
Now, many people are comparing the Twitter float with the Facebook float. Is the question, can Twitter outdo Facebook, or is there really a comparison there?
I think that they exist to some extent in parallel in terms of their users. But of course, when it comes to advertising, well, you know, adverts are either seen on one place or another. You can't really be both on Twitter and Facebook at the same time. And even if you are, you're going to see the advert. You know, if an advert is shown to you, it's all come back to us, doesn't it? That's because adverts are a tax on your attention. Yeah, and that's a sort of that's the most purely progressive tax in that sense. So with Twitter, yeah, I reckon that it's costing its 230 million users at the moment. That's pricing them. It would be worth about $13.9 billion. So that's pricing each user at about $60 each. So it has to get sort of $60 or more of advertising value out of them. So Twitter has to build itself as an advertising platform. It has to be attractive to advertisers. It has to be attractive to users. It has to build the infrastructure to be able to show those ads, to be able to get the ads into the pipeline and show them. So in a sense, it's a grand version of what we've just been talking about in the Tesco petrol station. You know, you've got a whole lot of people waiting in line to look at tweets, and hey, let's show them a relevant advert. Except that with Twitter, you happen to have a lot more information about who the person is, who they follow, what they talk about, all those sorts of things. So, you know, anyone who's faintly worried about the Tesco face scanning thing, you know, if you're on Twitter, actually, you've given loads more information away about yourself to Twitter and to all of its discovery engines than you ever would to a scanner in a Tesco petrol station.
There are a couple of things that you know, beyond just the number of users and the number of times you look at the website, that could affect its share price, I imagine. And one of them is the kind of the reputation of Twitter as a social revolutionary platform. Might that have an effect on how people view the IPO and whether they should invest?
I don't think that the fact that Twitter was used, and Facebook was used as well, don't forget, in things like the Arab Spring uprisings in sort of 2011, 2012, I don't think that actually that changes the value of it or its perception with investors who are looking to buy something on NASDAQ or in Wall Street. It's very much more about, is there growth ahead of this company? Is there revenue to be made? And does it have a business model we can believe in? So I don't think that there's any controversy in that. The thing that really threatens Twitter more than anything else there is the fact that IBM is threatening to sue it over some patents that it says that they infringe. Of course, it sort of has the sort of feeling of a shakedown, and the letter from IBM only arrived on Monday, apparently. But it says that Twitter infringes three patents, including method for presenting advertising in an interactive service, which obviously is the sort of thing that you think Twitter does do. But the question is, does it actually infringe that patent? And Twitter has said that it believes it has meritorious defenses to IBM's allegations. So it all remains to be seen. But Google had much the same sort of problem ahead of its flotation when Yahoo, which then owned Overture, Overture was actually suing Google over the display of ads using the AdWords system, where people in effect bid for things. And what Overture, then owned by Yahoo, was saying was, well, we had that idea first and we actually patented it first. And what ended up happening there was that Yahoo was given a whole bunch of Google stock, in effect, as a payout.
On that jolly note, you can read up on the latest as it happens at theguardian.com/technology.
Mike Butcher, Eric Elden, and Alexia Skostis.
The TechCrunch Disrupt conferences in San Francisco and New York are high points of the tech meets venture capital conference season in the U.S. And in recent years, the franchise has also spread its high-fiving tentacles to Beijing. Last week, however, the Disrupt conference parachuted into Berlin for its first outing in Europe. For Tech Weekly, our erstwhile producer Jason Phipps went along. And he joins me now to give me the highlights.
Guten Tag.
Guten Tag indeed.
Wie geht's?
So first of all, I wish I could ask this question in German, but I just can't. What is, wo ist TechCrunch Disrupt? Did I do that right?
Yeah, what is, was ist TechCrunch Disrupt?
Was ist, wo is where, isn't it? Oh gosh, yeah. My German is painfully bad.
Well, this is a piece of the valley which parachuted into Berlin. So TechCrunch, of course, we know, is the sort of very high-profile tech and VC blog started by the gregarious Mike Arrington some years back and then recently bought by AOL. An offshoot of TechCrunch is the Disrupt conference. It's been going for a couple of years, 2006, I think it started, maybe a little earlier. Someone will correct me on that. It started off as a kind of informal, dilettante-ish little conference in San Francisco, pulling in sort of Silicon Valley people to meet interesting startups. And it's kind of mushroomed, and it now plays quite a big role in the sort of what I say is kind of bad suits meet the guys with bad t-shirts conference, basically, where venture capital money people meet with ideas people.
And indeed, you ended up meeting quite a lot of interesting people.
Yeah, so I went along. One thing I noted straight off, I have to say, is just how incredibly male the whole thing is. I mean, I know maybe I'm sort of an innocent in this world, and I know that you complain about it often and Jemima complains about it often, just how few...
It's constructive criticism, I would say, yeah. Rather than complaints.
Yeah, it's just amazing how... yeah, constructive criticism. It's amazing how few women make it to these conferences. But one was a real standout, I have to say. I spoke to a young entrepreneur, a young sort of tech startup called Sizem. It's run by a very sort of gregarious, punchy, young tech entrepreneur called Anna Kolarevich. And she set up a website stroke app called Sizem. And I caught up with Anna to find out more.
My name is Anna Kolarevich. I'm 27, and I am the founder and the CEO of Sizem app, the app that loves your boobs. And we help women find their right bra size, which they can then shop not only bras, but bikinis and bust-friendly clothing And we use the measurements to provide them back to manufacturers so that they can meet the demand of the market, because they're currently not, because 90% of women wear the wrong bra size, because most of the bras that are needed aren't being available.
So sizing for women, it's a big issue, and I know a lot of media reports it. I know that some of the high-end stores offer special measuring services. There's a very, very high percentage of women who wear the wrong bra for years, and yet I haven't really seen tech take this on and try to find solutions. And this was, yours is one of the first I've seen. So break it down and tell me what Sizem actually does.
We provide women with a tutorial with a new measuring technique, which means you measure yourself without a bra and in different position, which is leaning forward, laying down, and standing. And we also incorporate like the breathing because this also affects the band size.
So it's a very effectively designed website at the moment, and you click on to sizemapp.com. You effectively bring up the instructions on how you should measure yourself, and then what you want people to do is actually put that data in.
Exactly. Like women, when they have read the tutorial, they can enter their sizes into the basic bra size calculator at the moment, and then they are provided with a UK, US, and European bra size. And also with a bit broader size. For instance, if you don't like bands that are too tight, you get a sister size, which is a bit wider.
Okay, and you showed me some really lovely graphics, which basically proved that the actual measurements of UK women, on average, when mapped out on a grid, a heat grid, were very far away from what is actually sold in
exactly.
most of the stores in the UK. So there's this mismatch.
Yes, even the media has been talking about like average bra sizes being about like 36C. But our statistics from 6,700 measurements that we have gathered so far show that the average bra size is actually about a 32FF.
Right, okay.
Which is just, yeah, totally, totally away from 36C.
Yeah. I grew up with sisters, okay, so I'm not afraid of a bra. I'm very aware of the fact that I think a lot of women just think bras are uncomfortable. They always did, and they don't think they should change it.
The problem is that the engineering hasn't changed so much in the past years. There's not been any, or not too many innovation going on with the bra wires, so that when the bra wire is uncomfortable, everything feels uncomfortable about the bra. But we are about to change that, and we're encouraging manufacturers to produce on the actual need of the women. So that's what we're going to measure to, so women have more comfortable wires.
Okay, for the women of the world, you're doing a great thing, but how do you plan on making money out of this?
First of all, from all the sales that we do for the different brands in our multi-vendor web shop. And the other thing is basically the software as a service for the fashion and the lingerie industry. That means they have access to the measurements of women basically willing to buy bras and clothing, which is specifically made to fit bigger busts. And then they can adapt their production, because usually huge lingerie conglomerates, they lose a lot of money. For instance, a Ukrainian fashion conglomerate, they lose about $3 to $4 million dollars per year by having sizes that the market doesn't need. They have to stock that and store that. And if they can produce on point on a cloud-based statistic where the women, when they measure again, the statistic is updated too. So they can, you know, like this season they need more of this size, next season they need a little bit less. So they can save a lot of money and actually produce the sizes that currently aren't being produced, such as bra size bands in 26 inches, which no one does at the moment.
So have you got much interest from retailers that you've approached about this?
They are interested. We are talking with a couple of smaller brands at the moment to do some customer development. But when we have everything ready, we're definitely going to approach the bigger brands.
Brilliant, Anna. Thank you so much for speaking to us here on Tech Weekly at The Guardian. And yeah, good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
So, Jason, did you enjoy that interview?
I did. I thought Anna was amazing. And it wasn't super unique or anything, but it was a kind of solid idea. You know, there's a lot of these ideas, I think, at the conference which were not so innovative, but just solid. Good ideas by people who have kind of a sophisticated revenue idea. They're not putting all their eggs in the one basket.
And certainly at a tech conference over the last years, I've really felt the influx of social media. And in the next interview that you did, in the actual interview, you are discussing a social device for your bicycle. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I mean, there was a few very impressive UK startups that turned up for the conference. And these guys are behind a smart lock for your bike. It's called Lock 8. They actually went on and won the Battlefield. And the Battlefield was a revelation for me. I haven't seen too many of these things. I've seen sort of pitch sessions, you know. Battlefield, in terms of the Disrupt conference, is quite intense. They basically have around a short list of in around sort of 15 startups. They whittle it down to 4 in the final. And it's a Dragon's Den style scenario. They get the startups up onto stage. If you are shortlisted to be in the conference, you get a little bit of coaching because it has a kind of style, Disrupt. It is very Valley style. It is very high five. It is very, hey, how you doing? You have to. You can't get up and do a sort of PowerPoint, sort of academic presentation. It has to be a very sort of Silicon Valley style presentation. And Lockgate really did very well. So well, they took away the €40,000 that was on offer. And of course, all the attraction by VCs that it garners if you win this. And I met one of the key guys behind Lockgate, Oxford-based materials engineer, I think he said he was. His name is Dr. Daniel Zajarius Feinzod. You could not make these names up in fantasy. The fantastic inventor's name if ever I heard one. And he gave me a sort of an outline of exactly what Lockgate is.
So my name is Daniel Zajarius Feinzod, and I'm the CTO and co-founder of Lockgate.
Okay, just quickly tell us, what is Lockgate?
So Lockgate is two things. It's both an incredibly smart lock, but it's also a device that connects your bicycle to the world. It's a social device for your bicycle. And I'm an avid cyclist, and I think about weight. So obviously when we designed this product, weight was one of the most important issues. So we went and the first prototypes were made of steel. Then we went down to aluminium, and then we found out that polycarbonate is almost the strongest steel, or even stronger sometimes if you reinforce it, but so much lighter. And that is what's important to me. I wouldn't mind carrying my Lockgate, which not only is a lock, but is providing data about my cycling. And I can track my bike, I can track my progress eventually. So this is so important to me. But carrying a D-lock, I never carry a D-lock when I go out riding. I never leave my bike anywhere. And I have it like, I hug my bike even when I'm at a pub taking a rest. Lockgate provides a solution to this, and I'm sure that my problem is every cyclist's problem.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I'm a cyclist, it is a problem. So it's a really smart lock, it's very unintrusive, it's not, how big is it roughly?
So the lock goes on the dropout angle, which is the angle that the two metal parts of the frame make on the back wheel.
Yeah.
So it goes in there, it's like a pizza wedge basically.
Yeah,
there.
A shark fin like.
And it's a shark fin, exactly. We like sharks, so that's why we designed it like this. But it meshes basically, it fits in the palm of your hand, the actual device fits in the palm of your hand, and it's very thin. And it's aerodynamic as well, so it won't drag your bicycle down. It won't do anything. It doesn't create any friction because there are no dynamos. It works by electromagnetic induction with the hind wheel. So it really doesn't take out, like, the power that you put into your bike. It's still going into your bike. We're just stealing a very minute amount and very efficiently.
It packs a punch in terms of the alarm. You said it's about 120 decibels. That's very, very loud.
Exactly. It's incredibly loud. In fact, in some places, 120 decibels are not allowed. So that's why we can curb the volume and the tone. So you can actually customize the tone, because if eventually everyone has a Lockgate, every time you hear that tone,
like
you'll just
tones, yeah.
Exactly, you'll just go, oh, is it my lock again? But you can change it as a ringtone and even customize it the way you want it, so it can be personalized for yourself. You can change the volume. Maybe you're very near your bike, so just a simple, small sound will alert you. But if you're far away, or if it's a very busy city, you want it to be very loud.
There's another byproduct of this, which is even more interesting, which is its kind of role as a kind of device for the sharing economy. The idea that it could be used as, without any of the infrastructure of like a Boris bike, it could be used to actually share your bike with people.
Exactly. The City of London have done an incredible job at setting Barclays bikes, or Boris bikes as they're known now. But the infrastructure that went into it was so expensive. And it still has flaws, because as I mentioned during the pitch, I've used Boris bikes quite a few times. And the problem is that when you're commuting, you go where everyone else is commuting. So all the docking stations are completely occupied. This doesn't require a docking station. Or you could just have racks that are compatible with a locking system. And the expense incurred to the city is minimal. And you could have private companies investing in creating a fleet of bicycles individually. I could say I want to put 15 bicycles because that's what I can do. A huge company could say, like, I'll put in 1,000 bicycles. And it's all linked up to the city. So you get a chunk of whatever is being sold because it becomes a communal way of sharing bikes.
What's your impression? I mean, not only are they talking about providing data about your cycling, but also things like bike sharing. Is this something that a bicycle lock can actually do?
Yeah, it can. This is a really interesting startup. It's a really interesting piece of kit. It's definitely aimed at a specific market to begin with. It's aimed at people who ride around road bikes, you know, that are more than a grand or maybe 2 grand. It's the kind of rider who is in lots of Lycra, who doesn't have a pannier, who doesn't have a rucksack. It's a sleek urban rider who wants a high-tech solution to a real problem, which is in urban areas, the weight of D-locks and various other locks and cables you have to carry, it almost makes having a light bike pointless because you add so much weight on trying to just lock it up. You may as well just get an old Dutch road bike, you know, it's pointless. So it's aimed at that market. That's primarily its aim. It's quite a sophisticated piece of kit. It's got a neat little hardboard. It's got a heat sensor. It's got a sound alarm, as they mentioned, which ranks up to 120 dBs, which would blow your ears away if you interfered with it. It can track your data. It's lots of bells and whistles on it. But the flip side of that, this neat piece of hardware, is that you can control it through an app on your phone, and potentially two things can happen in sort of the social market. One, you can either lend your bike out to a friend. It's a very easy way if your friend wanted to pick up your bike from somewhere. You could basically open the lock with your app or give them a key to open it. And the second thing is that we're all aware of these social city bike schemes. The Velo scheme in Paris obviously was the sort of pioneer in this, but we have our own Barclays-funded Boris bike here. There's plenty of cities, say like Oxford, who would like to do these kind of schemes, just don't have either the space or a massive backer like Barclays to build the kind of docking infrastructure on the bikes. Imagine a town like Brighton decides to do a very off-kilter kind of retro bicycle hire scheme. You know, recycle old bikes, maybe even make them bespoke. It could attach this on and it could basically build a very scalable bicycle hire scheme without any of the cost of infrastructure. It's pitched at that kind of project. And a lot of the people on the panel, a lot of the judges on this, thought that that was a goer. They could see that. It immediately sort of, that's what dropped with them. I don't know whether a lot of them were cyclists, but I think when they pitched that as part of their revenue model, the idea that they could, you know, it's a scalable, high-tech solution for cycle schemes in small cities. That was it. The lights went on in their eyes and the guys walked away with the 40,000 euros.
So TechCrunch's Disrupt conferences are never without controversy. They have in the past exposed the dark side of so-called programmer culture and also, more recently, the inherent sexism at the top levels of the technology industry. Reputations have been made. They have been broken. But in Berlin, the controversy, it was replaced by comic relief, wasn't it, Jason?
This was an
interview.
Yeah.
Between Mike Arrington and Tim Armstrong.
Yeah, they have these things, they're called fireside chats. Now, what does that evoke to you, Alex?
Well, growing up in the 70s in the United States, I'm just, you know, I'm thinking of the presidential fireside chat, you know, sit down and have a conversation or a one-way conversation with the president of the United States.
That's it. Warm, sort of collegiate, sort of sober musings over the tech scene. Well, fireside chats were nothing like that. And particularly when Mike Arrington, who was the founder of TechCrunch, stood in to do it. And one of the moments of hilarity at the conference and insight for me, because I think it exposed something about the tech scene in America that we don't see here, was when Mike Arrington, who, like I said, the founder of TechCrunch, did a fireside chat with AOL's Tim Armstrong. Now, AOL purchased TechCrunch back in 2011, and a whole series of things unfolded from that, the fallout of which was Mike Arrington left under a cloud. And his opening gambit to Tim Armstrong when he sat down on the chair on the stage was, why did he sack him? And it was hilarious and excruciating. And Tim Armstrong is...
I can only imagine.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
My God, it's like watching the kind of breakup speech, the breakup conversation between two people. Car crash conferencing.
One of the better, more kind of upbeat talks was by the kind of leading startup in Berlin. It was by SoundCloud's co-founder, Alex Leung. I caught up with Alex after the fireside chat to talk to him about a couple of things that he'd mentioned on stage, in particular, his tie-up with Instagram.
Hi, everybody. Hey, Alex, thanks for coming out today.
Hey, thanks a lot. It's so awesome to be home and to be at TechCrunch Disrupt at the same time.
Awesome. So, I thought we'd start off with something.
We're in your home patch, Alex.
Yep.
We're in Berlin, and we're at the first Disrupt conference, TechCrunch Disrupt conference. You said when you got up on stage, it's so great to be at TechCrunch Disrupt, and it's just so great to be at home.
Yep.
It's a rare thing for you. So are you enjoying the conference?
Yeah, it's really cool. I have to say, like, I'm still trying to, like, wrap my head around it because, you know, it's so great, obviously, to be home, but to be, like, at Disrupt and realize that it is at home in Berlin. Like, I still haven't quite parsed it, but, it's really cool. And I think it's a good... it's a good signal as well that, you know, I believe this is the first Disrupt that's done in Europe, and it's cool to see that it's right here, right next door. I actually, like, I just walked here this morning from my apartment, which was like, wow, that's cool.
The way to do it, yeah. Okay, well, I'll put all the London jealousy aside, yeah? They made a big mistake, but no, Berlin, SoundCloud in Berlin, it's strange because I think SoundCloud's become synonymous with Berlin.
Yeah.
It's one of the big, big tech startups in Berlin. I know you're Swedish, and I'm sure there's a lot of your family say, why didn't you do it in your home country?
Yeah.
But there was something very particular about Berlin that attracted you here. What was that?
Well, it was, I think, so both Eric and I, like, we thought about SoundCloud very globally from the start. Like, I think we'd been kind of inspired by the internet in general, where we felt like, yeah, it's one global place. There will be people using it all over the world. So we weren't thinking so much about kind of physical location for it, but we were in Stockholm, and we spent, like, a day here in Berlin, and I think, like, we really just really liked the vibe of the city. It felt like there was a lot of art, a lot of technology, and it had this kind of, like, punk vibe to it somehow. It felt like, you know, that's what we're doing with SoundCloud. It's any startup is very punk in a way. You're trying to say that, okay, I think the world should work like this, and, you know, it's technology and creativity, and that just Berlin just kind of, like, you know, gave us that feeling. So it was a very spontaneous thing. We decided in, like, a week and moved over and didn't really think it through. We just kind of felt it through, and then yeah, and then here we are.
It's been an amazing 12 months for SoundCloud.
The last 12 months have been all about growth, basically. Like, the growth has just been phenomenal.
And so give us some figures on that growth.
So today we reach over a quarter of a billion people every month. So that's through all of our different products. And people then, like, the creators on the platform, they'll upload over 12 hours of audio every single minute, throughout the entire day, every day, which is a lot. So it's really kind of, like, gotten to that scale where it's, like, it's clearly, like, the leading and dominant audio platform in the world. But, you know, it's exciting because it's not, like, slowing down in any way. It's just kind of, like, growing and growing and growing. And I think the way that we think about it is that what we're doing is in some ways so simple. It's just about how humans connect with each other through music and audio. And that's relevant for every single person in the entire world, which means that even though 250 million is a large figure, there's, you know, 2.6 billion people online.
Yeah.
So a lot more work to be done.
Okay, well, another giant, giant platform that does something very beautiful and has reached vast numbers of people is Instagram.
Yep.
And you announced a really interesting tie-up with Instagram today. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, sure. So basically, we're announcing our integration with Instagram today, which is also, like, it's the same thing. Like, it's very beautiful but very simple, in that, you know, when you, as a creator, if you upload a new track, or as a regular user, if you create a playlist, or... when you're creating something and you want to add an artwork to that, you can connect to your Instagram account and then just instantaneously choose one of your Instagram pictures and have that be sort of the visual representation of the track. And so it's very simple, but I think that it's... I'm really excited about it because it is, like, you know, We're two sort of large platforms that are that have very passionate users, very creative users, and are very good at sort of a specific thing. Like they're very good at the specific thing around images. For us, it's all about audio. But for users, obviously, life has both images and audio to it. So being able to sort of connect the platforms like this, I think, from a user perspective, makes a lot of sense. But I think it will also lead to like a lot of kind of interesting artwork on music and sounds, because I think both SoundCloud and Instagram kind of encourages people to create way more than before. So you get sort of to see these everyday moments from people. And I think being able to put together that, or both the image part of it and the audio part of it, is going to be really interesting.
And how does the integration work the other way around? How will SoundCloud feed into Instagram?
It doesn't fit into the actual, into the app itself.
Is that the next step?
We'll see. Like today it's all about really thinking, you know, the sounds that you have, or the collection of sounds that you've created, like how can you add your own sort of visual flavor to how you represent them as well.
Yeah. Mm. It's very Berlin as well.
Yeah, totally.
You said something very interesting when we were giving advice about, you know, what would you do if you were starting up a firm. You said, think in billions, not millions.
Right, yeah.
And there is something about the scale of SoundCloud's ambition,
yeah,
and maybe the scale of Berlin startups' ambitions. You think they need to be sort of go to the next level, is that it?
Well, I think sort of the idea with that is basically like we think of it as like web scale. We always talk of it as like web scale, which is just that I think that it's kind of stepping back from it, like we're at this like very special like time in history actually, where through technology a very small group of people can impact a really large group of people. So, you know, you can have, you know, 200 employees and impact over 250 million people. Like the leverage between that is huge, and it's all because of sort of it's partly because of the internet, but it's largely because of technology. And I think that it's mind-blowing that it is possible to be able to impact actually billions of people through how you think of the internet and technology. So for me, that just means that if you can do that, then that's what you have to do. Like in some ways, we've been giving this opportunity to be able to do that. And it's like it's not right then to be focusing on something with millions. I just like that's just kind of like my perspective on it. I think that we're in a really unique time to be able to have broad and deep impact on huge amounts of people in very, very cool ways, and why do anything else then? And it really is the idea of like to remind yourself to think in billions rather than millions. It's necessary because like the numbers are so big that the brain doesn't naturally operate on that scale. Like even millions is not natural to sort of like comprehend what that means. But so you need to kind of remind yourself all the way to think about that scale, because it is possible through technologies. And that's why, yeah, the billion is just the thing to think about.
It's also an interesting scale because how SoundCloud makes money, it offers a kind of freemium. It goes down the freemium line with some...
Yeah.
You used to have four premium accounts, and you've narrowed that down. Why was that?
So we went from four to two, and it was basically just that we'd had them for enough time to understand well enough how they function. So we said that we can scale it down to two accounts, which would be simpler for the user, simpler for us. They would be cheaper, so they would be more accessible, but it would still work out revenue wise to be the same for us. So we said, okay, that's a great trade. Like, you know, it will be revenue wise, it will work the same for us, but it will be easier for users, easier for us, more accessible, so more people can benefit from it. So let's do it.
Yeah. And how have you seen growth in mobile as opposed to desktop? Are you guys?
Yeah.
That must be an interesting kind of dynamic, looking at the kind of growth and then looking at that relationship between the two things.
I mean, it's to be honest, it's like it's totally wild. Like mobile usage at the moment is like I've never seen anything like it. It's growing so fast that it's just crazy. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people are seeing that sort of in general on the web. But I think particularly for a company like us, it becomes extremely important, because if you
think about it, like, sound is one of these amazing things that you don't even need the screen for it, right? So, and the screen is often the limiting factor on a mobile device. So, like, a mobile device is a perfect device for something like SoundCloud. So, and I think we really see that in the usage behavior. And I think it creates some really interesting kind of questions, because if you think of desktop web, it's always that the user has to go to the application or to the site, whereas as soon as it's on the mobile, it sort of changes that dynamic and you always have it with you. And I think as a company and as a platform and as a brand, you kind of all of a sudden you have the opportunity to create something which is much more present for the user throughout their life, not just like this app you go to every now and then, but that's really this kind of like continuous, constantly present piece for them. I think audio works very well for that as well, right? Like you know, you're driving your car and you're listening to something at the same time. So mobile is something we think about a lot, but it's already now the growth has been crazy, but we expect it to continue to just be completely nuts. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks a million. And thanks for hosting us in your hometown of Berlin.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That was our own producer, Jason Phipps, speaking with Alex Lung from SoundCloud. And Jason, thank you so much. All of our TechCrunch Disrupt coverage is on theguardian.com/technology. That is it for this week from Tech Weekly. There's more on the website, including detailed analysis of the latest from the ever-imploding BlackBerry patch. Head there for all the juicy details. Thanks to Charles Arthur, Samuel Gibbs, and to Jason Phipps in London. Send us your feedback. Leave a comment at theguardian.com/techweekly or get in touch on Twitter @GuardianTW. I'm Alex Krotowski, and we'll be back next week. See you then.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.